Ladies and gentlemen, the latest news of the war brought to you by our trained staff members at home and abroad. Now, first news today comes to us from London, England.
This is London. John McVane speaking. We've had no direct official information from Singapore so far today. Authoritative quarters in London today state that while the general situation in Singapore remains very serious, there are indications that in some ways it's better. British troops are counterattacking in certain directions, and these counterattacks appear to be successful. The counterattacks are being made toward the line that the British first held between Sungai Kranji and Sungai Jurong. The British are also counterattacking northward against the forces of the second Japanese landing. It's said in London that there's no indication that the Japanese succeeded in getting any large number of troops across the causeway that connects the island with the mainland. Dispatches reaching London from Singapore today say that Japanese bombing has hardly touched the business and residential quarters of Singapore. This is taken to mean that the enemy hoped to get the city intact. There's still no word of any fighter protection of the island, which is probably the most serious point. Military quarters in London have no confirmation of the Japanese claim to have crossed the Salween River in Burma in force. Their information is that only small patrols have been crossing back and forth, and no change in the situation has been reported. Naval quarters in London today referred to the Singapore situation as obviously serious. Asked whether the Singapore naval base will be destroyed, these quarters said they hope that Singapore won't have to be evacuated. It's hoped, too, that the base installations can be destroyed if necessary, but it's pointed out that the base would in any case provide good shelter for Japanese naval units, and the Japanese probably could protect it from the air with planes based on the Johor airfields. British bombers were over northwest Germany last night, and Bremen was the main objective. The docks at Brest were also bombed. All the British planes returned safely to their bases. Mr. Churchill's announcement of Lord Beaverbrook's powers as production minister was about what political observers here expected. The arrangement is thought to be an improvement over previous governmental production machinery, but it's being generally pointed out that Beaverbrook is hedged around with a lot of thorny limitations. In the first place, Ernest Bevin, the Labour Minister, is one of the Cabinet's strongmen. He comes out of the reorganization still holding control of British manpower. If by any chance he and Lord Beaverbrook should disagree on what should be done with manpower to speed up production, the dispute will have to go before Mr. Churchill and the War Cabinet for settlement. So a lot depends on how well the two ministers cooperate. Secondly, while Lord Beaverbrook is to exercise general control over the supply and allocation of war materials, the various supply departments will operate semi-independently, and the ministers in charge will be directly responsible to Parliament. Today's Daily Herald asks how Lord Beaverbrook can do his job thoroughly if he's forbidden to interfere with the administration of departments under his so-called direction. Beaverbrook's job seems to be essentially to act as a sort of troubleshooter in British production tangles and to link up British and American production. Some critics are saying that both of these are full-time jobs, but the general feeling is that Beaverbrook will have a pretty good try at doing both of them. The whole scheme is admittedly an experiment, and if it doesn't work out, we'll probably be changed. Most people are hoping it will work out. We're faced with the long, hard job of building up enough armaments to overcome Germany and Japan, and the British feel that by now their production should have reached 100%. The fact that it hasn't is making a lot of them impatient. The recent demand for a cabinet shake-up here was one result of that impatience. The average man feels that the situation has become serious enough for him to insist on efficient action by his government. The thought that inefficiency is being tolerated because of Conservative or Labour Party machine politics or because of personal friendships irritates the man who hears every day of new Allied defeats. Mr. Churchill's thumping vote of confidence in Parliament proved that practically everyone believes him the best war premier Britain could have, but it didn't give anyone confidence that he's got a streamlined, efficient team working with him. That's why most political observers figure that now Mr. Churchill has shown the world that his country trusts him, he'll put through a real cabinet reorganization in the next few weeks. One of the schemes that has helped to ginger up war production in Britain has been to send the men who use the war machines to the factories that make them. And the other day, the RAF tried a new scheme, taking parties of aircraft factory workers to RAF stations. And one group of war workers who make the guns and shells used by British fighters went to a fighter station equipped with Spitfires, and each man and girl of the party had a chance to press a Spitfire firing button and send a stream of shells into the firing butts. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
Now, here in New York, we have the latest reports on the fighting in the Pacific, and the word is that bitter, last-ditch fighting rages on the Bataan Peninsula. Jap reinforcements are pounding General MacArthur's battered, weary, and already outnumbered defenders of the Philippines. But the doughty Americans and Filipinos apparently still hold out on the peninsula, although they may at any moment be forced by sheer weight of enemy numbers to retreat to Corregidor Fortress in Manila Bay. Japan, meanwhile, is celebrating Empire Day. It's the anniversary of the founding of the island empire 2,602 years ago. But Emperor Hirohito is not, as his warlords had hoped, as yet celebrating the fall of Singapore and the Philippines. Now, the Dutch are offering stubborn resistance to Jap invasion forces, trying to outflank the fabulously rich Indies. But Batavia concedes the troops are engaged in delaying actions. Enemy forces are driving toward Makassar on southwestern Celebes Island and the Banyamasin in Borneo. Now, Banyamasin is 400 miles west of Makassar and 300 miles across the Java Sea from the great Dutch Naval and Air Force base of Surabaya on Java Island proper. Batavia expects the Japanese to try and effect a landing on the key Indies Island soon. The All India Radio has broadcast a denial of enemy claims that the Japs had managed to establish a bridgehead on the west bank of the Salween River in Burma. Now we turn overseas once again, this time to our reporter in Stockholm, Sweden. Go ahead, Sweden.
Hello, this is David Anderson speaking from Stockholm. The position of Norway in Germany's new order is the subject of further conversation in Berlin diplomatic circles. Wilhelmstrasse sources point out that the powers granted to Quisling was only one step in a closer cooperation and development of German-Norwegian relations. Now it is rumored that Quisling will personally visit Berlin, at which time it is not impossible that he will sign his name to the anti-Comintern and tripartite pacts. This will mean, of course, that the Germans will then officially recognize the existence of a full peace between Germany and Norway, and perhaps even an expansion of the powers originally granted to Quisling. Then, too, Berlin sources say that Quisling will get permission to set up a kind of National Guard, a force somewhere between a regular army and a police force. The numbers will, however, be restricted to approximately 20,000, and they will be under the command of Quisling himself. As I pointed out to some of you on Sunday night, this seems to be but one more step in a direction which will lead Norway away from her position as a strictly occupied country to one of complete affiliation to the German Reich. Therefore, its importance cannot be minimized in the light of German intentions and ambitions for her so-called new-ordered post-war Europe. At the same time, another one of the northern countries comes in for its share of attention by the Stockholm press. That country is Finland. It has been some time now since we have heard of the fighting Finns, but the answer is to be found in the explanation that the Finns have been relatively inactive for the past couple of months. But more important to the Swedes at present is the fundamental basis for why the Finns are fighting. The comparatively bad press which the Finns have been getting in Sweden prompted the Finnish Foreign Office to arrange a trip to Finland for some of the leading Swedish newspaper men. The purpose was perhaps to clear the air in Swedish-Finnish relations. If this can be accepted as their intention, they failed. This trip gave certain newspaper editors a vivid first-hand picture of Finnish aims and intentions. Aims and intentions which are not being received with too much admiration or understanding by the Swedes. Then, what are these aims? According to recent Finnish propaganda pamphlets, they are to incorporate the whole of the Kola Peninsula and eastern Karelia with Finland, with a possibility that Leningrad be thrown in for good measure. Recent Finnish propaganda sounds surprisingly like the German, in that they call Finland's old borders as, quote, momentary borders determined by mere chance, unquote. Then they go on to indicate that eastern Karelia and the Kola Peninsula comprise a closed natural region and should be saved for Finland. It is only fair to point out that large sections of the Finnish population do not embrace these plans, and as far as most Swedes are concerned, these propagandistic catchphrases are falling on deaf ears. The Swedes at present have to be shown that Finland's war is purely one of defense, and in the words of Dagens Nyheter, it will be easier to reason about common interests and risks when Finland has come so far that she chooses between a purely defensive and a marked expansionistic program. This is David Anderson returning you now to New York.
Next, the news at home, as reported by Earl Godwin from the newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. It seems odd, against the background of gloom from the Pacific, still to find people here in Washington pulling and hauling through motives of self-centered partisanship or office and palace politics and whatnot. There's not the slightest doubt here that for every mile the Japs put behind them in their dash to Singapore, which we here expect to fall and how, it means more burden and more effort on our part, and that means you. And yet we find the farm bloc, as represented by their senators, finding a way to circumvent the administration's definite plan to make parity the price ceiling on the main farm crops. They have it fixed up this way. You know, the government lends huge sums of money on the big main farm crops, corn, wheat, and cotton, and then holds that crop as security against the loan. Of course, it really amounts to a sale. Really. Now comes the Senate's Agriculture Committee and drafts a law which would forbid the government to sell those crops that they're holding on these loans under any circumstances until and unless the producer gets 10% above parity. Now, that may become a law, but with all that has gone before it, I doubt it, because I think the President and Secretary Wickard have devised a policy which would not sell any, which would not keep prices up above parity, if they can get that far. You know, it's been hard work to get some of farm prices up that high. Well, price boss Henderson may find it necessary also to ration tea. There has been a rush, so it's reported here, to buy this last few days, and it looks like hoarding to Henderson. And there's a whale of a fight looming on the bill, which includes $277 million for the St. Lawrence Waterway. The administration wants that waterway as a defense measure, and there is a large aggregation of senators and representatives who will put up a last-ditch fight against it on the ground that it is not defense after all and couldn't be finished in time to be of use to anything remotely connected with defense. But all the weight of the administration is the other way, and they'll put all the weight they have behind driving this item through. Opposing members say the whole river and harbor improvement program has a tremendous lot of doubtful, political, old-time pork barrel items which are of no value to defense at all and of doubtful value to anybody except the congressmen and contractors in the regions affected. Quite a row. The amount of money that would be authorized for the entire Rivers and Harbors project is stupendous, well over $1 billion. And in the light of present criticism against foolish spending, $300 million sums seem to be mountain high. But remember, so far, in the last few days, or in this session of Congress, the only sum knocked out in debate was Donald Duck's poor $80,000. All the rest of it has gone sailing by. From the West Coast comes a story of the G-men rounding up more Japanese aliens of class and prestige, together with firearms and 75,000 rounds of ammunition and other such gadgets. Here in Washington, the House of Representatives has complimented J. Edgar Hoover and his G-men, overworked force that they are, published the fact that they're doing 4 hours overtime a day, gave the FBI $2.5 million more for the anti-espionage and fingerprinting work, extra work for the next 4 or 5 months. And I mention this because this constructive item was a part of the same appropriation bill which produced that Donald Duck and Dancer furor, and it hid from the public some of the really constructive work that it's been doing here. Mr. Roosevelt sticks to his overall strategy of saying that we will hold off the Japs, kicking them in the shins as often as possible, and invading the Axis countries to wipe out Axism, beating them eventually on their own home grounds, and that's all from Washington at this time.
Thank you, Earl Godwin. Report from our capital concludes this morning news. You've heard direct from John McVane in London and David Anderson in Stockholm. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the Red Network of the National Broadcasting Company. WEAF, New York's great news station, brings you the news as it happens.